everyone, and welcome to On Social Health and Change. I am Hannah Stanley, your host, and this podcast is presented by Adler University. Today we are talking about misogyny in sport culture, which, boy, does that topic bring up so many different avenues and opinions. And what we are going to do right now is welcome our guest, Tanya Pruitt-White, who has been on the program before and is the program chair of the sport and health psychology at Adler University. Take a moment, if you would, too, and hit subscribe so you don't miss any of this. Tanya, tell me a little bit about your dissertation. This is so in your wheelhouse. So I want to know exactly what you spent a good chunk of time researching and then defending so that we can frame our conversation that way.
Sure. So I'll start from the very beginning. I did my master's and PhD at the University of Tennessee, and I had no idea what sport hostesses were. It was not in my radar at all. And I was working as an academic compliance graduate assistant at the University of Tennessee. And all of a sudden, on a weekend, I saw all of these very beautiful women all dressed in orange blazers and started realizing, like, what's going on here? And someone nonchalantly said, oh, those are the Vol dolls. And so immediately I started thinking, Vol dolls, what's going on? As I started doing more and more research and looking into this and investigating it, I started to recognize that programs of about 30 to 60 plus women would be part of the recruiting process for Division I football, primarily the bigger football programs, and that it was very normal culture, and that these women would be sometimes the first individuals that would greet an athlete as they came off the plane to visit a certain university, that they would be in charge of taking them all around the institution, showing them the academic buildings, the football program facilities, and things of that sort, and that they were a vital and integral piece of the recruiting process. And so I decided that I was going to venture off and I was going to do an autoethnographic dissertation. And so what I did is I interviewed former sport hostesses on their experiences. In addition to that, I observed on game days on the football field. I was present during different academic meetings where football athletes would be there with sport hostesses as well. And so I wrote about basically this one-year process for me and the interviews and what I learned.
Okay. On the surface, this makes perfect sense. The student athletes are going to be, they're trying to get them to pick their school. They want their program to be amazing. Mm-hmm. Football, we'll stay with football because that was where you spent a good portion of your studies. It makes sense. When I was in college, I used to give tours to prospective students. If you're going to have a tour anyway, and it's a high school boy, pick a pretty girl. That's not silly. That's smart. Mm-hmm. And, mm-hmm. So were these students at the Vol dolls, these sport hostesses, are students?
Yeah. So I will say that I interviewed from other universities as well. But yes, at the University of Tennessee at the time, they were students. I think one of the things that's interesting, yeah, it is smart. We know that sex sells, quote unquote. Mm-hmm. But the interesting thing is how these women are picked. So, for example, there's women of many different races, heights, weights, and basically a direct quote from a woman that I interviewed who was part of the selection process of who to pair, which hostess to pair with the recruit. They would look into, what does his girlfriend look like? Do we know, does he have basically a preference towards blondes or brunettes, or a mixed light skin woman or a darker woman? And so they were very strategically placed and paired with the different recruits. And if they didn't know, they would sometimes put both a white woman as a hostess as well as a black woman with a certain recruit because they didn't know. So yes, it's important to, if you're trying to sell a university, but it's very strategic, and there's reasons why they would place certain hostesses with different recruits as well.
And now it's gotten so much easier to do that than 10 years ago because of Facebook and everything else. You're able to find all of those pictures and preferences and things that would be, you know, make that more obvious, those choices. So when you looked at the program, the sport hostesses who are doing enough to help recruit, because you want the guys to think, man, there's a lot of pretty girls at this university. Mm-hmm. this is the choice for me. Are the girls who are involved in this program, the young women, are they benefiting? Are they being paid? Are they getting scholarship money? I mean, I've never seen a scholarship application for this.
Mm-hmm. So it depends on the university, and it also depends on when they went through school as well, because I interviewed women who ranged in age from recently out of college to up to 36 years of age. So there was some differences. But mostly speaking, the women were paid minimally, potentially minimum wage. They would maybe be given one credit hour for the semester. And so when we look at the amount of time that these women are putting into the program, they had to go through a testing process. So they needed to know who the head coach was, the names of all the, you know, the offensive line. They needed to know who was a starting quarterback. They needed to know all the rules of football. So they go through that testing. And then in addition, they needed to know things about the recruit that was coming onto campus. And then they would spend on a recruiting visit, potentially all day Friday, Saturday, and then see the athlete off on Sunday. So a significant amount of time would be spent in the recruiting process for these hostesses. And so they would be paid minimally. They wouldn't be paid during the time at the football game for some of these programs. And the justification was that since they were students at the university, that they'd be going to the game anyway, and that they should be excited and happy that they were getting such good seats during the game. So, yes, they might be paid. And at other institutions, they weren't paid. It was that some women were part of this program because they had their families had been Auburn or any other institution. They had been fans their entire life. And so to be a part of the football program was something really cool for the young
woman. It was an honor.
Yeah, an honor. And the other thing is a lot of the women did benefit. So they learned if you could sell an athletic program or a football program to a student, an athlete who was being recruited by every institution in the nation, and you could sell the University of Tennessee or Duke or whatever it might be, then you could sell anything. And so these women went on to be very successful in their careers. And I will say, all the former hostesses that I interviewed, they were anything from teachers, lawyers, doctors, a corporate recruiter. So they were very successful women. And so they did benefit in that way of learning how to sell, how to present themselves to many different types of people that would be coming through.
All right. I have to ask this question. Did any of the women, the former sport hostesses that you interviewed, marry a player?
One did.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like there would be a cynical opinion that they're just doing it to meet the players who are then going to be pro.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's what's the interesting thing of the women that I interviewed. They would talk about there were different types of hostesses. There were the women that were using this as a stepping stone. Let's say they were getting a sports marketing degree. And
that
so
makes
this
sense.
Was a great stepping stone.
That's an internship. Yeah.
Right. Exactly. Then there would be other women who they were really big fans of the football program. And so that was a piece. And then others might be that they really just wanted to be almost a direct quote. They wanted to be the hostess that was there on the football field looking pretty, getting attention and be connected with the football players themselves to marry them, to find their ticket, and those types of things. And so the women within these programs, which might have anywhere from 30 to 60 plus women in the program, they really knew and segregated based upon why they were there. And from what the women told me is that they knew who the good quote-unquote hostesses were and also who were the bad quote-unquote hostesses were as well.
And the bad ones were the ones who were in it for the ticket.
Yeah. Okay. The women that I interviewed would flat out call them the jersey chasers, or that they were there and being used by the coaches to provide favors to the athletes.
And favors, you would mean?
Sexual intercourse, lots of flirting, kissing, acting like you're the girlfriend. And so if you think about it, you have a high school boy who might be 17, potentially 18, but probably 16, 17, 18. And you have a junior in high school, a very beautiful woman.
Or junior in college,
or
yeah.
Junior mm-hmm. in college, a very beautiful woman providing you this type of attention. You know, you can see how they're like, wow, this is pretty awesome. But at the same time, some of the other sport hostesses would say, you know, these 16, 17-year-old boys, they're just young kids. And so when they're coming to these recruiting visits and going to football games and they're the biggest recruit in the country and all the fans are hounding them, want their autograph, they would cling to the sport hostess and it was like a big sister relationship. So the interesting thing is the coaching staff and the directors that are pairing the hostesses with the recruits, they know what the athlete would need or would be looking for. So, for example, is he coming with his parents? Or is he coming with his girlfriend? Is he coming with a grandma? Is he coming with his uncle and best friend from high school? And so depending upon who the athlete was bringing with him, his personality, they would provide the appropriate hostess. So there were times when they provide the hostess who is studying to go to med school, who, you know, next year is going to Ivy League school for med school. So they're going to provide that hostess to the parents and to that recruit. If a recruit's coming to campus and is coming with his best friend and it's his second visit, then they might have a little more leeway of which hostess to provide.
A little bit more of a party.
Yes.
So, okay, so I'm glad we handled that because I knew there would be somebody going, well, they were just in it to marry into that. There's money. There is money attached to this. And there's, while we don't want to necessarily, we all know, especially at these bigger schools, there's money attached to the program and there's benefit for the players. Mm-hmm. While they're not necessarily paid, they're working on that. But there are perks to being a big player at a big school.
For sure.
And there's perks to being the girlfriend of the big player of the big school. So now that we've got that out of the way. So so then we have these students, these young men who are coming to be recruited by these larger schools, which is primarily where these programs exist. Mm-hmm. And they're being presented with the pretty girl. And I don't disagree with that. However, it's sending a message. It might be sending a great message. You know, if they're there with their parents and they're getting the professional girl who's all buttoned up, who completely knows her stuff and really can say, you know, this is a great choice. I have a good education. I'm going to be a doctor. Yay, this university. That's probably a great message. They're valuing the education of their students. However, what message are we sending if we send the quote unquote jersey chasers to the student athlete to go tour, you know, show them around? That's not sending the best, like, we value our women message to those student athletes.
Oh, definitely not. And some of these programs will flat out ask the recruit what type of hostess they would prefer to have during their visit. So they're sending the message that women are
You can
are
pick
objects.
And choose.
Yeah, that you can pick and choose. Oh, would you like a different hostess for your next visit? Or when they offer multiple hostesses to the same recruit. So, okay, well, you choose between these three women. And the women that I interviewed would talk about how there would be dissension amongst the women when the recruit would, you know, be most attractive to one woman. And the other women would be like, well, what am I here for? Why am I here during this whole weekend and this recruiting visit? You know, I might as well go home and study. And so if you think about it in the recruiting process of why is the first individual that's meeting, you know, potentially these recruits at the airport or picking them up, why is it a student? Or, you know, female, male, why is it a student? Why isn't it the head coach or an assistant coach? Why isn't it one of the current athletes and those types of things? And so the first thing that you're sending them the message that, okay, you're going to come to this university and you're going to be a football player, basketball player, whatever it might be, and you're going to have your spew of women, you get to choose. And so if this message is sent to you time and time again, it becomes very normalized. And you think that every woman that you meet should want to be with you, want to have sex with you, should be attracted to you. And then it creates this power dynamic and this thought process that I'm not saying it's okay, but you can begin to understand if this is a message you're sent from 16 years old, why we then have potentially professional athletes or collegiate athletes that sexually assault or beat up their girlfriends and things like that.
And again, I'm glad you clarified because I was about to, and I will again, that this none of this is okay. The behavior, the bad behavior, is not it's not okay. But you do understand that the culture is not sending that message in any manner. Mm-hmm. It might be, you know, if they're coming from a home where they're very structured and they understand right from wrong. But many of these students are not, because as we've discussed before, their whole thing was to get into school and get into, you know, get a scholarship and play play the sport, either to get the education or to then play pro. So then they've grown up with girls in high school being more attracted to them because they were successful, because that's inherent. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's survival of the fittest. You're going to be attracted to somebody who is more successful and more powerful and stronger. And so then they go, they're used to that at some degree in high school. Then they go to college, where these women are essentially thrown at them, mm-hmm. or at least provided for them. And so how long do these hostesses, they're used for the recruiting process, but then are they utilized with the players throughout their career? Do they still have, I don't want to say access to them, but are they at parties, and do they kind of fill that role as well?
So I think it depends on the hostess, and it depends on the program, also depends upon the recruit. So I know within some of the hostess programs that they end up developing a really good relationship with a recruit. And I would also say that hostesses feel a lot of pride when a recruit decides to come to the university.
Sure.
And, you know, and then they develop this relationship, and then they decide, oh, well, you know, let me show you on campus, let me help you, and be a legitimate tutor to the student and a mentor to the student athlete. Because as we've talked about before, these student athletes are under a lot of pressure, and their first point of access into the institution might have been this hostess, might have been the first person they confided with, the first person they trusted. Because if you think about it, in this recruiting process, they're probably not going to trust the coach or the student athletes that are currently there. They're not going to really tell them, well, I really want to go to this institution over yours, but these are the reasons why. But they might be more inclined to tell their big sister, they might be more inclined to tell the young woman who is flirting with them than they are going to be able to tell or want to tell someone else. So they, a lot of times, these hostesses, if they develop the relationship, develop a very trusting relationship with the recruits, and a lot of times are the one individual who might not be using the recruit for their own gains.
Because they're not being paid a lot of money.
Yeah.
They're not getting a commission on these student athletes choosing that particular university. While they would feel pride in it, it's not like, wow, you get three of these recruits, you get a bonus this month. Mm-hmm. That's not it. What about alcohol? We have underage student athletes coming to campuses. Is that something that plays in?
Yeah, for sure. Again, it depends on who the recruit is coming with. The parties are a big deal. So if you have a student athlete who's coming and they know that they like to have a good time and they're coming with their buddies, then it's the sport hostess's job to, as a lot of the hostesses would tell me in the interviews, is that they were actually playing the role more of the babysitter at these parties, because the coaches maybe didn't trust the other athletes because they were going to be partying themselves. So the sport hostesses would be the one to make sure that everything was okay, that they weren't getting too drunk, that they got home safely, and those types of things. So attending the parties, although it wasn't on the record, it wasn't part of their responsibility, there was an underlying message from coaches and programs that they should be attending these parties and, you know, entertaining at whatever level the recruits that are on campus.
Making them understand that this was going to be a good time start to finish.
Yeah.
This school.
Yeah, this was going to be a good choice.
Mm-hmm. And so now we have underage drinking. Always. These recruits are always underaged. Mm-hmm. And it's being provided for them because of a party, either a player party or whatever. You mentioned that the coaches have a role in this, mm-hmm. in choosing the appropriate hostess for the player's preferences and who they're touring with. Why do the coaches think this? I get the pretty girl. I'm totally down with that. And I don't even, I wish she was paid better for what the university is making off of many of these players. Mm-hmm. I feel like it's a valuable time if it's handled correctly. Like, I don't even blame them. But what role do the coaches play aside from choosing? They have to be turning a blind eye to a good portion of this, or outright encouraging some of this bad behavior.
Oh, for sure. I think it's the pressure that every other university coach or program is doing it. And so if another school is doing it, your rival school within your conference is doing it, then you better be doing it one step better or just as good, because you might not get the recruit otherwise. And so there's this pressure that you have to get the best recruit, you have to continue winning. And so it becomes a cyclical process for the coaches, and also turning a blind eye. A lot of times it might not be the head coach that has there's an awareness that it's going on, but they're not the one coordinating it or planning it. They're hiring someone else to plan it. And so mm-hmm. Then I can turn my back to it, because I wasn't the one that knew about this party. I wasn't the one that assigned the hostess with the recruits and those types of things.
Plausible deniability.
Yes.
However, these head coaches don't start as head coaches. They've worked their way up through the system. So at one point, at some university or another, they were likely more involved with this system.
Yeah, for sure. And also because they're part of the culture, and a lot of these coaches were probably the star in their high school teams. They're the ones being recruited. They don't really see a problem with the culture, with the process.
All right. So this is the old boys network. This is how great it was when I was recruited. Mm-hmm. And so now let's see if we can do better. Let's see if we can provide you a good time, because this is how it's always been done.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, I'm a coach now. I'm in my 30s, 40s. And gosh, I would have loved to have beautiful women that
fawning all over me,
because now I'm not there. And just these are the glory days.
How long has this program, this practice been going on?
Since the beginning of football.
As long as men have played football.
Yeah, they've been going on. And this is the interesting thing. They might not have always been documented, mm-hmm. but, you know, as early as the 60s and 70s, there's the Bengal Babes, you know. And the other thing is, a lot of these hostess programs had names, the Bengal Babes, the Florida Gator Getters, the Ball Dolls, right? The list goes on. Then what ended up happening in 2001, when there was a case at the University of Colorado with Lisa Simpson, where she was allegedly raped at a recruiting party as a hostess in 2001. Finally, then in 2007, the University of Colorado settled for $2.5 million to Lisa Simpson. And so then it was around that time that the NCAA in 2007 said, okay, we have to do something about this.
Well, admit that we know that it goes on.
Yeah. And then in doing something about it, they could no longer be housed within athletic programs. They couldn't be housed within athletics programs. They had to also incorporate some males. And then they had to change the names of these hostess programs. So, you know, now they're admissions recruiting programs and things like that. And they might be housed within the admissions department, but part of the team is still the athletic staff and the athletics programs.
Are the girls at all recruited in the same manner for female athletes when they come to campuses? Are they given, as you said, males are now incorporated into this program? Are they met by a handsome boy at the airport, a handsome young man?
Not in any of the research that I've done.
Let that sit for a second there, people. This is now there is a genuine lack of money in most female athletic programs. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't even compare. There's some female basketball programs across the country, Tennessee being one of them, mm-hmm. that are incredible and do make the university money. However, football and basketball, depending on the school, are the big money makers, and mm-hmm. and the men's programs specifically. I hate this. I hate. Now, are the women recruited to go to that school to be a part of that program? How are they brought into the program?
Okay. Again, it depends on the university and the program. Mm-hmm. Some women had told me that coaching staffs had gone to bars. So, you know, a lot of nightlife in college towns,
sure,
had gone to the bars and personally recruited the pretty women that they would see out on a Friday, Saturday night. Other places, there's a long interview process. So you apply just like you would for a job, and then you go through an interview process of being interviewed potentially by the senior sport hostess who has the most experience and tenure in the process, as well as potentially a player and coaches, and asked all sorts of questions, why you want to be in the program. One sport hostess told me that she was asked to give a cheer to see if she would like go the extra step and to really sell something. So they go through a process, and sometimes they're, for some of the women, in that process, they were also asked if they would consider losing weight to be a part of the program. So they are at some places recruited, and at other places they apply to be a part of a sport hostess program.
On-campus jobs, though, that's a thing. I just never saw this particular job as one of those that were an option.
Definitely.
When I went to, and I did go to a bigger school. When we think about the message, and I'm quite sure this was a big portion of your dissertation, the message that this is sending to the athletes, mm-hmm. and how this is warping even their opinion of women mm-hmm. in general, in society, in their particular lives, how is it a disservice to these athletes that this is a thing?
Yeah. I think over time that athletes, male athletes, start thinking of women as something to be consumed. And they also objectify women and start to learn, how pretty are you? How much, how far can I take this relationship? And start to see women as something to be used rather than a human being to have a relationship with or to talk with and things of that sort. I think that they're also starting to, as we talked about before, gain a sense of power of that I can have any woman I want because they're always thrown at me. And so then over time, and you objectify someone, anyone for that amount of time, it just becomes a very normal way of being. And I think in the culture of sport, the more successful an athlete becomes, I can see why, in the research that I've done, I can see why they objectify women, and because women aren't human beings with ideas and thoughts, there's something to be consumed because they're always thrown at the athletes.
And when we do get to the point, not as much in collegiate athletics, but in pro sports for sure, because even league minimums is a ridiculous amount of money. Mm-hmm. They're able to buy and sell anything. Mm-hmm. So to have women be another possession, that I get where their brain kind of goes there,
mm-hmm.
because that's how it's always been for them.
Yeah.
If they are part of that 1% that does make it to pro, they have enough money. There are going to be women who are attracted to them because of the money.
Definitely.
But because of that, they're not necessarily forming that relationship.
For sure. I completely agree. And there's no incentive to form the relationship because they've never had to. It maybe hadn't been modeled to them anywhere, potentially then outside their home or their family life, with a mother or a sister. So there's it's not modeled by the coaches. It's not modeled by university presidents.
Right.
It's just never been something that they've had to think about.
Okay, so when we now look at the differences between male and female athletes, we've talked about the fact that the female athletes are not recruited with the same sort of vigor, mm-hmm. And it is likely because the female athletes and the female athletic programs are not making the same kind of money for that school. Mm-hmm. It's not as necessary. The coaching staff, there's no real way for that coaching staff to move up into pro.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not what it is. Collegiate coaches, that's kind of their thing. Let's say collegiate football coaches and basketball coaches, if they're incredibly successful, they could go pro also.
Mm-hmm.
So there is a lot of many, many layers of benefit to getting the right recruits, putting the right team together, and winning.
Mm-hmm.
And at any cost, there's not so much on the female side.
Mm-hmm.
But not only does it, it create an opportunity for our male athletes to we're not condoning, but we understand if they do go down that road where women are possessions and women are can be bought and sold and they can do what I tell them to, we can understand how that could occur.
Mm-hmm.
But for those that don't go pro, for those that have to have a normal life, where are we? How is that message evolving that women are equal? Women, women are intelligent. Women are valuable, and that you should cherish your relationship with other people. You're no longer an athlete.
Mm-hmm. I don't think it is. I think that is completely missing. So I think that what we find is then when we have athletes that are no longer athletes, they're still using their athletic identity of, you know, well, I was a running back at this institution, you know, and going back potentially to their hometowns and, you know, who I am. And so basically benefiting from that athletic identity for as long as they can, and potentially seeing having the misogynistic views for as long as they can as well, until it's time to, like, maybe throw in the hat. And that's the hope, is that eventually they say, okay, well, this isn't benefiting me. Maybe I should treat people like human beings.
But I wonder how often that occurs.
Yeah. But I think that part of that becomes part of the identity for these student athletes is being the big quote unquote man on campus. And then that doesn't leave them immediately when they leave the university or they're no longer an athlete. You know, it sticks with them for potentially a lifetime. And so what do you mean you don't want to marry me? What do you mean you don't want to date me? Like, that's just unheard of potentially for some of these student athletes, because a lot of women throughout their high school and collegiate career have just wanted to be connected with them, just wanted to sit by them in class, you know, wanted to be their sport hostess. And so that's what they're used to. And then when they no longer have that athletic identity, they're no longer having that fame, it can be really confusing potentially for them. And you had brought up O.J. Simpson in our conversation before mm-hmm. going on air. And, you know, you think about that, like, well, what do you mean, Nicole, you don't want to be with me, right? And then all of a sudden, potentially being like, well, you have to want to be with me,
right?
I'm O.J. Simpson.
And then, and this is a whole other topic that we would need lots of stats and charts and whiteboards for, but when we, specifically in football, when we put in head injuries, traumatic mm-hmm. brain injuries, and things that would very likely injure them to the point where their behavior choices are not necessarily controlled by themselves, where they have other injuries driving that, then we've got a whole other set of issues.
For sure. The other thing is, if we look at the culture of football, it's a lot about dominating other opponents.
Yes.
And so it's very physical.
It's very gladiator-ish.
Yeah,
yes.
For sure. And so we have young men who are given this experience of, okay, I'm going to be a gladiator, and people are honoring that, and I'm being benefiting from this behavior. And then we take that athlete out of that environment and expect them not to react with that type of emotion when they are angry, because in sport we get angry a lot, right? And there's
you
a lot
feed
of,
off of it. That's
lot,
the thing.
Right, they feed off it all the time. And then for some athletes, it may be that they're not able to turn it on and off. So, oh, when I get really angry,
you hit.
Yeah, in a domestic situation, well, this is what I do. This is what I know. And so you can see a lot of connects, truthfully. And I mean, people don't want to hear this, and I'm not saying it's okay, I'm not condoning it, but you can see where the behaviors occur.
Absolutely. The question then becomes, how do we teach them from, when we're teaching them from 5 years old to hit and to channel that anger into a hit or into a tackle or into aggressive behavior, how do we then step back and go, but you don't do this? Like, it's okay here, but not here. That seems like a really, really not at all focused on, at least currently, but a big challenge for parents and coaches and everybody else, especially when the coaches haven't been taught to coach. They just learn to coach from the people who coach them.
Right. So one of the things, this is not where I'm potentially the expert on this, but one of the things we can do in sports psychology, we talk about, is teaching athletes to turn on and off basically an identity or a role. So when I go to practice and I put my shoelaces on, now I'm going into, I have an alter ego, right? And this is my alter ego. And this is what I do here. And then having this routine where then after practice, after a game, then intentionally turning it off. Like, okay, now I can be Johnny, I can be normal. Like, this is just something, this is my alter ego. This is my identity and the behavior that I perform, because sport is performance at those times. And then teaching them that, okay, this is what happens when we're on the field. So having, so youth football coaches could have some type of ritual that they do with their little peewee football players. Okay, having a talk, right? How many peewee football coaches will have a talk? Okay, we're going to, you know, we're going to tackle, you know, you're going to be running full force and you're going to tackle someone else, and have discussions that this is not okay behavior outside of this football field.
This is where we work it all out.
Yeah.
And then it goes away.
Then we're going to do it. And then at the end of the peewee football practice, have a conversation. Okay, this was really great, right? You know, hopefully they're not tackling, depending on the age, but you know, depending on where you go, they are. And then having conversations afterwards that, you know, this is what happens within football practice and in game, so this doesn't happen outside of sport. What are other ways that we can deal with our emotions and our anger outside of sports? And having conversations, and you can do that starting in second, third, fourth grade in these peewee football teams. But if I was a betting woman, which I'm not, but if I was, I would bet that this is not happening as part of their
program.
Rare
at best. Yeah, rare at best. Now, you and I, both women who have a particular higher than average likely interest in athletics and sports, and probably a tremendous knowledge base based on the fact that you did your studies, and I have a background in athletics as well. What I have noticed, and I don't know if I'm handling it better or if the conversations are improving, but what I have noticed is a, not necessarily a disdain from men that I will talk to, many, but if we get into a sports conversation, I'm very often discarded. They don't either care what I have to say, they don't believe that I have knowledge about whatever sport, and they will sometimes, if they realize that I know what I'm talking about, they keep going, they keep pushing until they trip me up, just so they can prove that they are better because they are a man, in my opinion. Where is that coming from? Is that an inbred male thing that they have to be dominant, or is that based on this culture that they've gone through as athletes or as boys that can identify with the athletes?
Yeah, I think that experience is very common, that as a woman or a female, that if you're athletic or if you have an interest in sport, that you're infringing on a very masculine or machismo domain. And so Maria Burton Nelson wrote a book, The Stronger Women Get, The More Men Love Football. And so it's around this whole idea, is that sport for the longest time had been a primarily male domain. And so it was where men could play out these roles of being strong and dominant. And so then when, in theory, when you have a woman that comes in that's very feminine, that doesn't, you know, doesn't know the talk, or that comes in saying that she knows a lot about football and is interested in football, it's almost, and the idea of Maria Burton Nelson is that as women, we're infringing on this domain that for years was only a male domain. And so maybe unknowingly to men, that they're not doing it consciously, but it's like, well, you're not supposed to be here. This is where I connect with my buddies. This is where I'm able to, quote unquote, be a man. This is where there are no rules. And then when a woman comes in, like, all of a sudden now we have to have rules. Now the conversation has to change. Now I have to be more sensitive, or open-minded, or I'm going to be challenged more with some of the things that I say. And so over time, you know, they're like, well, we don't necessarily want you here. And they don't maybe say it directly, but it is by the things that you said. Well, they'll continue to challenge you, try to break you down, that you don't belong and make you feel as you don't belong. And so I think that a lot of women in sport are trying to pave the way and to create a culture in sport that is more accepting, is more open-minded. And I think that's really powerful. And sport is just a microcosm of society as well.
women reporters in the locker room was a huge barrier. And when that became something where they were no longer banned and they were able to go in the locker room, I remember those conversations of now we have to cover up. Now we have to be conscientious of how we speak. Like, you should have anyway. You are on camera. You are on microphones. You know, this is a thing. But now having a female reporter in the locker room is commonplace.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. I think that as more and more women get into sport, not only careers, but play sports, it does become something that is not, you know, mind blowing or head turning any longer. And I can say, as a sports psychology consultant, I had people tell me that, oh, you'll never work with a male team. It'll never happen. You know, what are they going to share with you? And then come to find out, I have the perfect career for a male who wants to talk about his vulnerability or not feeling good enough. He's not potentially going to tell that to another man, but he will potentially tell that to a woman, because a woman is, right, gender roles, more loving,
right,
more accepting that he could be vulnerable. And so that's really interesting that these unspoken and spoken rules that are placed in sport of who's welcome and who's not, I think it's experienced by all women in a lot of different careers.
Recently, a station here, and we are here in Chicago, Illinois, a television station hired a female sports anchor. And I thought it was great. Obviously, she had enough skills to make it to the number three market in the country. And one, there was a troll of some sort that posted below the hire. You know, it was announced in the papers and online that this woman was hired. And I actually looked for the quote, and I don't know if this person removed it or what, but it was buried and I couldn't find it. It was a man on social media saying, oh, good, another token female who's going to bring nothing to the sport. She's not going to give us any insight. She's only there because she's a pretty face. And it was everything in me not to completely go off on this guy online. And I didn't, because it would not have changed his opinion. Mm-hmm. Because if he's that dense, to have put that opinion out there, like, clearly this woman will bring nothing. She could have never understood the sport. Like, a man would obviously bring something more. Well, a lot of the male sports reporters have never played sports. They just were big fans. So in that manner, and I know this because I know a lot of them, but in that manner, they're coming to this from exactly the same spot, from fandom, mm-hmm. and from being a student of the game, not necessarily a player of the game. Mm-hmm. How common is that in society, and is it changing? Do you view it as changing?
I think it's making small changes as we see more women in sport, getting jobs as coaches, as athletic
directors. Yeah, NFL special teams coach, I believe.
So as we see more of that, I think it's becoming a bit more normalized. However, we see women continually to be sexualized. You're only hired because you're a pretty face, and
right.
I want you to know that.
Mm-hmm.
Or dehumanized. And so it's the same thing as our earlier conversations that is happening to women who choose to have a career in sport. And I think that a lot of women that have a career in sport have to be pretty strong-willed and know what they potentially will be up against, whether they're a sports reporter, a coach, a sports psychology consultant, because sport is a male domain.
Yes, for at least for now. Mm-hmm. Working in this town for quite many, many years, and having access to some of the sports teams, a lot of the front offices are very equal. You know, 50-50, we've got women, male throughout marketing and sales and on-field stuff, because mm-hmm. there's a lot that goes into that as well. I was actually quite surprised to see how well balanced it was in most of the teams around here. And a lot of those jobs you don't get right out of college. Sometimes you do have to work in the minor leagues and then get brought over to a big club.
Mm-hmm.
It's very interesting how you don't necessarily go, well, I was a marketing major and I should work for you, professional sports team. And they're like, not so much. we have lots of you.
Mm-hmm.
But so it did seem to me that behind the scenes in the front office, it was far more balanced mm-hmm. than it had been even a decade earlier.
Yeah.
So they were being respected for their opinions and their knowledge base. But the men in those fields that were their coworkers had no choice but to respect them because they were depending on them to make this team better and present, you know, sell more and make the team more valuable. But I wasn't seeing that necessarily. Like, I loved going to the front office because I could talk sports and everybody would be like, they would listen to me like I was a human and I knew what I was talking about. Whereas I would be at a bar and talking sports and I would have five guys shut me down.
Yeah. I think one of the things I would ask is in these positions at not only college and universities, but in professional teams, were these women the accountant, the public relations person? So their expertise was in something in addition to the sport, right? So, and so I think where the switch might be is when the woman's expertise is in the sport. So coaches, sports psychology consultant, reporter, where there might be more of a barrier because, as, for example, as the accountant for an institution or as the marketing director, mm-hmm. I'm the marketer for this team.
Right.
I'm not the one who knows the game, the X's and O's, even though the woman might.
No, right? It's a valid point.
So that respect might be there because, well, that's a side. Like you like the sport, you know the sport, but you're really here because of this.
Because you're great at marketing, but you could market anything.
Yeah.
That's a valid point. And one that I really hadn't considered before because I was so pleased that it was so balanced and that they were respected in their positions and listened to. But you're right. We're not seeing female scouts. We're not seeing, maybe we are, but not nearly as many officials, women, you know, women officials in hockey or football or anything. There's a few. Mm-hmm. And it's a big deal when they're around. And what's interesting is while you do have the trolls who are going to rip on the female sports reporter, a female anchor in this case, it does when they hired the female coach, I think it was the Seahawks. I heard sports radio defending the heck out of her.
Mm-hmm.
Men.
Yeah.
Because they were like, no, she's good. If they were going to pick someone to be, and I used this example to somebody the other day when we were talking about this content, I said she was essentially the Jackie Robinson uh-huh. of female coaches.
Mm-hmm.
But they chose somebody who has the schooling, who has the education, who has the background, where even the men's sports reporters, instead of going, well, that's no place for a woman, they were going, she's the one. She's the one who can make this better for everybody else.
Uh-huh. Which is so important.
So important.
Mm-hmm. And for women, that it's essentially like Jackie Robinson, right? The woman that has to have everything to start opening some of the doors for other women who might have an interest in pursuing a career in sport. The other thing I would add, I would say that, let's not be male bashing here, that also sometimes women, we're our own worst enemies. And so we can look at youth sports, and I do this all the time. So I look at youth sports, maybe a girls' basketball league, third, fourth grade, and I look at the coaches. And the majority of coaches, now we're post-Title IX, mm-hmm. the majority of coaches, so these women would be athletes themselves. It's not the moms who are coaching their daughters. It's no. The fathers who are coaching their daughters. And so I think that's one of the things is thinking about as women and having children, you know, whether you have a daughter or you have a son and you have an interest in a sport, go coach your child, right? Go demonstrate to your daughters for future generations that I know a lot about this sport and that I'm not going to have my gender stop me. And so I think that's one of the important things of that we're raising daughters and boys to see it as very normal to have women involved in sport. And I do see that as a place to really change that as well.
My son played Little League last year, and of all the teams and all the practices and everything, there was one mom mm-hmm. that coached. And I remember being surprised. And then I went, well, gosh darn, that's great. Good for her.
Yeah.
And then I made up excuses as to why I couldn't do it. I'm like, uh-huh. I should do that. But then who would watch my daughter? And who would, you know, there were other things. And I think that women in general maybe rely too much on that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I did it, then my husband couldn't do it. And that's his time with kids. And there's kind of this, like, this is how it's always been. And what I love about the fact that women are breaking these barriers is because it leads, it puts that out there that a woman is holding that job, and then other women see it and go, oh, I didn't even know that was an option. Right. I who knew? I just always thought, because it never even occurred to me that it was a man's world. Mm-hmm. But I didn't see any woman in there. Mm-hmm. So I think that these women are really, I think it would be great if we put them on postage stamps. Like, yay, these are great women. They're doing big stuff instead of just as an athlete. Mm-hmm. They're taking other roles in this and leadership, recruiting and scouts and officiating.
Mm-hmm. I think you made a great point that seeing women in sport is so important, because I think a lot of us, we don't even second guess it. We don't say, oh, you know, like, when will there be equality? Well, when half of the women's NCAA basketball coaches are women, right? We don't even, it's just so normalized. And so as we start seeing more and more women, thinking about it as an option for a career path outside of just an athlete is really important. So I think that we have younger generations that are starting to think, well, gosh, you know, I've seen Robin Roberts, I've seen Elena Deladon, I've seen Rebecca Lobo as a reporter, right? All these ideas and people that, oh, I could do it too.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And not necessarily always the beautiful women. Right. We're getting women of all, you know, calibers and color and sizes. And I think that that's really demonstrating that knowledge is going to win. We don't need necessarily the beautiful face on the sidelines. But it just needs somebody who actually can bring something to the game, can bring insight, ask good questions, and really enhance that broadcast. Mm-hmm. or that reporting forum, however they're doing that. It really does allow our daughters and sons, because I always hesitate that I'm like, that's such a good example for girls. And I'm like, it's actually great for everybody, because we want our sons to grow up thinking that this is the norm.
Definitely.
It's not weird that a mom is coaching Little League. It's great. It's good that the parents are so involved.
For sure.
Okay. So if we were, when you did your dissertation, when you did your year, how did this affect your opinion of collegiate athletics? That is loaded.
Yeah, that's very loaded. It's so interesting because a lot of people romanticize Division I athletics. And from my experience, I feel as though I saw a lot of the corrupt behavior. I was living in it, working in academic compliance, working as a sports psychology consultant at the time, as a graduate assistant, working on a PhD, doing this dissertation. I got to see things that took all of the romanticized ideas away. And so I think is when I think of Division I athletics, I think that a lot of the student athletes, they're athletes first and students second. From my experience at these big time D1 schools, I think in addition, a tremendous amount of pressure, a lot of commodification. And I think that a lot of NCAA athletes, at least in the money making sports, should be paid. That made me think about that as well. I just saw a corrupt side of it. And so I'm forever going to think that first, because I saw some things that I thought were pretty horrific.
So you're altered in your fandom and in your overall view of how at least those Division I schools, those bigger schools, those programs are run.
Yeah, like I don't even think twice when I hear about an academic scandal, a recruiting scandal. Everyone's doing it. And I've had Division I coaches saying, oh gosh, you know, everyone's doing it, it's no big deal. And if you ain't cheating, you ain't trying. Like, those are normal thoughts, and they don't even think twice about it. And so I think that when the NCAA finds a scandal, or that it's like, okay, well, you're the school that got caught. And that's really what I think.
Well, and that's the thing. Aside from the positioning of women as commodities, which is deplorable, mm-hmm. I don't necessarily blame the women for being involved in the program. It's a job. It, you know, is a means to an end for many of them. And like you said, some of them come into it with incredibly high ground morality and leave with that intact. However, aside from that, if everyone's doing it, where's the harm? Mm-hmm. like doping in cycling. Everybody's doping in cycling, so it's still fair. Like if they're all, you know, I've always questioned that. But is there harm that's being done? We can review, and again, this is Tanya Pruitt-White. She's the program chair for sport and health psychology at Adler University. This is on Social Health and Change. This is a marathon podcast today. We're talking about misogyny in athletics. You're seeing, and I'm just going to speak for you, and you can correct or jump in, but you're seeing an injustice for the student athletes in that it's athlete before student. Mm-hmm. So you're not doing a justice for them in actually educating them or teaching them how to prioritize things.
Definitely. I think student athletes, not all, but most student athletes at big time institutions and the big time sports, if you look at who's playing, they're primarily Black athletes, not always, but they could be coming from backgrounds where the public school system wasn't great, where their socioeconomic status might have been lower. And so they get to these institutions and as a neo-plantation type of mentality of who's benefiting. Academically, they're not benefiting. So the presidents at universities, their salaries, coaches' salaries, the NCAA are the people that are benefiting. And these athletes are, it's not about them obtaining a career, obtaining an education. It's about how much money can they make our university? What can our win-loss records be? How can we get more students to apply to our university and be admitted? Those types of things. And the whole time, and the sport hostess is just being one piece of that, right? And helping at that money-making scheme. And who's harmed most? It is the student athlete, because they leave, and not only now do they maybe have this very misogynistic idea of the world, but they potentially don't have a quality education. They don't have the social network that they need for their career because they're no longer going to be a professional athlete. Like we talked about, only 1% of college athletes. It's less than that. We go pro. So the people that are benefiting aren't the student athletes.
Which is the whole reason they go to school.
Yeah.
But a lot of these students, the whole reason they go to school is to try to go pro.
Yeah, I think they're fed the dream. And, you know, if you're fed the dream that, you know, you're going to be the next
Michael Jordan, or
Peyton Manning, you're going to be the next one. And so rather than putting time in to the academics or education, you're going to put time into that sport because that's what everyone notices you for. That's how you get your accolades. That's why you're in the newspaper.
That's why they leave after their sophomore, junior year, because if they can go high in the draft, it makes them more money and they don't risk injury their senior year, which could wipe out their entire career. So they actually then send the message that the education isn't the point. It's the money and it's the career. I love that Emmett Smith went back to school and got his degree because he had left early. So we do see examples, but we need to, I think, present those to our children, both female and male, of athletes who value what they do or make good investments. Shaquille O'Neal is an incredibly rich man, most of which has nothing to do with basketball because he's been a really wise investor. And I would love if that story was far more prominent, because what we do hear constantly is the bad choices that are made. Those are always in the news. People love the dirty laundry.
For sure. Well, I think the other piece is that I wouldn't fault a collegiate athlete for going pro after sophomore year, because
I don't either.
To make the money, and when you wouldn't have those means otherwise, it actually makes sense, especially when you can go back.
Grab it.
To your institution, and you can go back and you can obtain your degree, and then it also helps the institution with their graduation success rate. So they're going to want you to come back, because the other student athlete that's leaving after their sophomore year is flunking out.
Right.
Then, well, you leaving will help us because you'll come back at some point potentially, because you'll have the means and money to do it.
You had tons of money and you could have chosen to go anywhere, and you came back here to get your degree. So it really does send that. So This has just been fascinating. I'm quite sure that a good portion of people didn't even know that these programs existed, the sports hostess programs. I went to a larger D1 school and knew of them, never witnessed, never mm-hmm. saw. But the one thing I did, I got lost in a building once. I got off the elevator, the wrong floor. Man, the football offices were beautiful. I was like, that's really funny because the engineering wing doesn't look anything like this. It was really obvious where their focus was. Mm-hmm. It was beautiful. Mm-hmm. It was to attract people.
Definitely. Yeah. And, I think beautiful women should still be in sport and should have every right to be in sport. But I think the ways that sport is using women and sexualizing women should be questioned.
Frequently. Mm-hmm. Tanya Pruitt-White, Program Chair of Sport and Health Psychology at Adler University. Adler University presents this podcast on social health and change. Thank you for your time and your insight into some really Division I athletic programs. We appreciate it. Please hit subscribe so you can continue to have content like this populate automatically into your device wherever you listen to us on. I am Hannah Stanley, and thank you so much for listening.